Our next case this morning is United States versus Townsend. Merrill.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Adam Merrill. I am appointed counsel for the defendant, Lewis Townsend, and I am here to talk about two due process violations that we believe occurred at the sentencing of Mr. Townsend in the district court below. At its heart, of course, due process is about fundamental fairness. And we believe that Mr. Townsend was deprived of that right to fundamental fairness at his sentencing hearing in two ways.
Before you get too far into your merits argument, we have a threshold argument about the timeliness of the appeal.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd be happy to walk through that. The issue with respect to motions to reconsider based on three Supreme Court cases as well as this Court's decision in U.S. v. Rollins is that so long as the time to file an appeal has not expired, a substantive motion to reconsider tolls the time to file an appeal until that motion to reconsider is decided. And so within 14 days of the entry of the judgment, not the oral announcement, but the entry of the judgment, Mr. Townsend had that 14 days to file an appeal. Within that 14 days, he filed a motion to reconsider, a substantive motion to reconsider. And then once that motion to reconsider was decided, he then had an additional 14 days, according to the Seventh Circuit Practitioner Handbook and these cases that I mentioned, to file his notice of appeal, and he did that as well. So the only way that you could find that this was untimely is either by finding that the motion to reconsider had to be filed within 14 days of the oral announcement, which is not the standard under the practitioner's handbook or under the Rollins case and the trio of Supreme Court cases, or if you find that the motion to reconsider itself didn't toll the time to appeal. And neither of those things is true. We don't believe there's any doubt in the record about that, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The motion for reconsideration was not, in your view, a Rule 35 motion.
It was not captioned as a Rule 35 motion. It wasn't an attempt to correct, you know, some sort of technical error the court had made. It was a substantive motion because the defendant learned for the first time at the oral announcement of the sentencing that the government had withheld critical information concerning the officers who testified, two of the officers that had testified at the hearing. It was news to the defendant. He still didn't have access to that information. So the motion to reconsider was, we don't believe this sentencing should be finalized until we have a further proceeding, until we get this information. So we asked the court to order the information be turned over, continue the sentencing hearing, and then allow us the opportunity to cross-examine the two officers concerning that.
So you were asking the court to reconsider its ruling that the Giglio information that had been sealed, or that the information that it had allowed the, based on the sealed, was it an ex parte motion?
It was a sealed ex parte motion that we didn't learn about until this court unsealed it as part of its procedures.
And the request was to reconsideration the ruling that you were not entitled, or that your client was not entitled to that information before sentencing.
That's correct.
This was a guilty plea, right? This wasn't trial information.
That's right. The only issue in this case was an enhancement under the sentencing guidelines in terms of coming up with the calculation.
Didn't it also raise the other issues, the same issues you're raising on the appeal, juvenile conviction? Did it address that as well?
Your Honor, just because I haven't looked at that in the last 24 hours, I don't recall whether it did. I know the thrust of the motion was, this is new information to us. We still haven't seen it. We believe we're entitled to it, and we would ask the court to vacate its sentencing determination, get us the information, allow us to have the information, allow us to cross-examine the officers concerning this, and then finalize the sentence.
Doesn't Rollins have to do with a motion for a new trial?
Your Honor, my reading of Rollins is that it may have been factually what was involved, but Rollins is about motions to reconsider. And as well as, you know, the Supreme Court cases of U.S. v. Healy, U.S. v. Dieter, and U.S. v. Ibarra.
Right, but there isn't any such thing as a common law motion to reconsider. All of that has been superseded by the rules.
I believe if you go back and read those Supreme Court statutes, that they do say that there is continues to be a non-statutory, non-rule-based right for a general motion to reconsider.
And that a sentence?
Your Honor, we have not seen any cases that distinguish between a sentence and a new trial. In all three of those cases, the government, I think at least in two of those three Supreme Court cases, tried to limit a defendant's ability to challenge a decision made below. And the court simply said, motions to reconsider, general motions to reconsider, right, that are not made pursuant to a rule or statute, can be made and are timely so long as they're made within the time provided for an appeal.
Is there anything after the Sentencing Reform Act, other than Rollins, which was a motion for a new trial, captioned perhaps as a motion for reconsideration?
Your Honor, all I can say is that the Ibarra case was decided in 1991, and that was the last of the Supreme Court cases. In my research, I did not discover any courts drawing a distinction among these issues. And you know, the Seventh Circuit Practitioner's Handbook, for example, you know, indicates as well that this basic principle that you can file a motion to reconsider within the time to file an appeal.
In a criminal case?
In a criminal, you know, I don't remember whether Rollins has to do with a criminal case. I didn't see the cases drawing a distinction. It must be because it's captioned U.S. v. Rollins. I could look at it when I sit down. But I believe it was a criminal case as well as these other three cases were criminal cases as well.
The question is whether the motion to reconsideration or motion for reconsideration goes to the sentence imposed, because then it's severely limited by Rule 35.
Your Honor, I don't read it that way. The motion was not brought pursuant to Rule 35 and pursuant to the statute.
I understand that, but it was a motion trying to reopen the sentence, and Rule 35 prohibits that except in very narrow circumstances.
It was a motion to try to reopen the judgment, which is really the final step in the process.
Because of an alleged sentencing error, that's what Rule 35
gets
at.
Because of a due process error in terms of the discovery that the court allowed us, Mr. Townsend, to get in order to rebut the government's assertions at the sentencing.
Rule 35 is limited to arithmetic, technical, or other clear errors. Your view is this was not that kind of error.
This was not. This was a substantive due process error that we really went to the heart of Mr. Townsend's ability to rebut the government's evidence. This wasn't a sentence where the court just considered the papers and pronounced a sentence. We had 4 days, and three officers testified at three of those 4 days, and then we had argument at a fourth day. So it was the show in terms of sentencing was figuring out whether this enhancement would apply, and that would be part of what the court considered. And we were never given the opportunity to see this material. We didn't even know about it, and we weren't permitted to examine the officers concerning it.
So that may become an issue for appeal, but it's not a basis to modify the sentence. And the court is statutorily prohibited from modifying the sentence, except by reference to Rule 35 or some other statute, and I don't know what your procedural hook is here.
Well, it's a general motion to reconsider, which we believe can appropriately be brought in terms, including in cases involving sentences, as long as it's substantive. And we believe that is what was.
The questions that are being asked from the bench go to whether those cases are correct after the Sentencing Reform Act, which severely circumscribed the district court's ability to modify a sentence or reopen a sentence, regardless, except within the boundaries set by the statutes and rules, and this doesn't seem to fit.
Your Honor, we don't read, I haven't read Rawlins or the trio of Supreme Court cases as depending on statutes or
all
rules.
All those old ones, you know, are superseded by the Sentencing Reform Act. So I'm talking about everything forward of 3582, which says no reopening except by reference to Rule 35, which is limited to the circumstances that Judge Griesbach mentioned.
So I don't know what survives
that statutory development and the limitations of the rules. What survives of this common law motion for reconsideration? So this, these more recent cases may not be any good.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to look at Rawlins while the government is making its arguments and refresh myself about that particular point.
Okay. We ate up all your time. You didn't get to the merits, so go ahead. You can talk about the merits.
Oh, that's fine, Your Honor. I'm happy to take care of it on rebuttal. I mean, it really has to do with the issue of the Brady material. Judge Castillo had found that these two officers had applied to a state court judge to get a warrant in a different felon in possession case. These are two CPD officers. We believe that that went to dishonesty. We had previously asked the government in a written request pursuant to Rule 16, and we invoked Brady and Giglio, for documents relating to dishonesty.
But this is a defense witness, right?
It became a defense witness after the government realized that they would have to turn over this material. That is what we believe happened, because we were told that there were no such materials, and both of these officers were on the government's witness list. And it was only later that the government, we believe, figured out that if we call Officer Murphy, who was the primary questioner, who was the primary arresting officer, that we would have to turn over this damaging or this, you know, potentially exculpatory material. And so it was in that context that the government decided not to call him. They didn't bring it to our attention. They filed a sealed ex parte motion, and the judge below granted the motion and said you don't have to turn this over. And we believe that that, you know, violated Mr. Townsend's right to due process. They should have disclosed it. They should have turned it over, and he should have been permitted to ask these officers concerning that, because the enhancement was based entirely on the officers' testimony about what Mr. Townsend said when he was arrested. So their credibility was at issue.
But the sealed information had to do with only the one officer that the defense called.
That is not correct, Your Honor. Officer Murphy, who was the one that the defense had called, has been a longtime partner with Officer Hanrahan. And Officer Hanrahan and Officer Murphy were partners in the Simmons case, where Judge Castillo found specifically that Officer Murphy in his affidavit had lied, but he also found that they were partners and had engaged in other, what he called, questionable police practices. So we believe that those practices, it appears to us as if Officer Hanrahan would have been involved in this affidavit that was provided to the state court judge as well. It's just he just wasn't the one that signed it. But we weren't able to go into any of that information with either Officer Hanrahan or Officer Murphy because the government didn't disclose it. And we believe they took an unduly technical view of that, of their Brady obligations as well as Rule 16 obligations. And we believe that the decision should be reversed, and we ought to be permitted to get that materials and question both of the officers about them and before the judge pronounces a final sentence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Mecklenburg?
May it please the Court, Sherry Mecklenburg on behalf of the United States. The appeal in this case is untimely and should be dismissed. If this Court considers the issues raised on appeal, the sentence below should be affirmed because the District Court did not abuse its discretion. In terms of the timeliness of the appeal, the defendant talks about a general motion to reconsider, but in a sentencing context, that has been eliminated. Because the Rawlins case, the Ibarra case, they didn't deal with the sentencing context, so they did not have to deal with the language, the unambiguous language of Section 3582, the Sentencing Reform Act. The Sentencing Reform Act basically took sentencing out of any kind of general motion to reconsider. Rawlins, Ibarra, can still coexist with the government's position in this case, because none of those cases were about sentencing. This motion is about sentencing, no matter how the defendant captions it. If the defendant takes the position that it doesn't fall under Rule 35, then he had no authority whatsoever to bring it. If he had authority,
A defendant, though, and I think Rollins and Ybarra, those were government motions to reconsider, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But any time a defendant files a motion to reconsider a final judgment in a criminal case, isn't it going to affect sentencing?
Not always, Your Honor. A defendant could file something for, well, it, ultimately, if you're affecting guilt, it would affect the sentence.
Right.
But this motion
was... doesn't your interpretation result in the conclusion that while the government can bring motions to reconsider, the defense can't?
No, Your Honor, because even in the Dotz case in the Sixth Circuit, which dealt with this issue directly, it was a defense motion. And what that court concluded was that in the sentencing context, there no longer is a motion to reconsider in general. There are two main differences with the Rollins, Ybarra type of cases in this case. Here, there's no contrary authority. There's nothing that prohibits a general motion to reconsider for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, whereas here, as both the 11th Circuit and the 6th Circuit in the Phillips and the Dotz case said, that there is the unambiguous language of the Sentencing Reform Act. The other issue is, or the other difference is that in Appellate Rule 4B3, that provides for certain motions to be, the time for filing an appeal does not start until the final disposition of those motions. That includes a motion for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. 4B5 provides, though, that for a Rule 35 motion, the time for filing an appeal is not stayed. So based on the unambiguous language of the Sentencing Reform Act, the defendant cannot bring a motion to reconsider a sentence, either the procedure of the sentence or the substantive nature of the sentence, except under the provisions of that act, which this court recognized in the Smith case. And in this case, the only way the defendant could have brought a motion, his motion to reconsider, was Rule 35. Rule 35 does not stay the time for appeal, and therefore the defendant filed his appeal too late. In addition, the district court did not abuse its discretion in holding that the government had no duty to disclose the Simmons opinion to the defendant. The defendant's speculation about why the government didn't call the witness, Officer Murphy, the defendant's discussion about what was promised where, there's nothing on the record on that. Suffice it to say that the government disagrees. But more importantly, when the government learned that the defendant was calling Officer Murphy as his witness, the government disclosed the Simmons opinion to the court, which was the decision maker in this case. Citing the Souffrant case, the government explained that it had no duty to disclose information about a defense witness. In an ex parte order, the district court agreed. In addition to the fact that there was no duty here, because under Souffrant it's not favorable evidence to the defendant when it's about the defendant's own witness, the district court has also held that the Simmons opinion was not material and that it did not affect the outcome of the sentence. The district court stated that it did not rely on the testimony of Officer Murphy in holding that the sentencing enhancement applied, and it also held that even if the defendant had used the Simmons case to cross-examine Officer Murphy, whether it would be direct examination or cross-examination, the court's factual finding as to the sentencing enhancement would not have changed. In the absence of materiality or a duty to disclose, there is no violation here. As far as the Simmons case referencing Officer Hanrahan in any way, there is nothing in the Simmons case that talks about Officer Hanrahan engaging in questionable police practices. The words that the Simmons case uses is that the officers, which presumably included Officer Hanrahan as Officer Murphy's partner, conducted minimal steps to corroborate the information that the confidential informant had given them. There's no finding that would suffice as a Giglio finding as to Officer Hanrahan in the Simmons case. Moreover, the district court, the decision maker, had that information. He had the Simmons case. The government submitted it to him. So if there was anything in there that affected Officer Hanrahan's credibility, the district court certainly would have considered that.
That was the entire evidence, the Simmons case?
As to Officer Hanrahan. As to Officer Murphy, the Simmons case actually found that Officer Murphy had signed...
The Simmons case itself was all the exculpatory evidence you went to a judge and asked him under seal if you could withhold?
Yes, Your Honor.
There wasn't other police reports? There wasn't anything else?
No, Your Honor.
And he already had the Simmons case?
Yes, Your Honor. The government submitted it to him in the ex parte motion.
I'm unclear why all this is ex parte, why you just... And it's sentencing at that. Everyone knows about it. Why would this elaborate procedure?
Well, as the government stated in its ex parte motion, it had no duty to disclose the Simmons case to the defendant about his own witness. And second of all, the government had some concerns about what would happen at the sentencing with the Simmons case. The government had concerns about the use of the Simmons case as sentencing. This was an officer who was being called by the defendant, and yet there was no indication that this officer had any favorable testimony to offer the defendant. Everything indicated that this officer would testify in support of the sentencing enhancement.
Now, I'm not questioning why you brought the motion. I just don't understand why it was ex parte and why this had to be under seal, that sort of thing.
Under the ex parte motion, Your Honor, the government indicated that it did not want to give this to the defendant if it did not have to, so that there was no questioning of the so that the defendant did not use it to question the officer and just try to embarrass him in some way or harass him, because there did not appear any other reasons for calling this officer. As a legal matter, the government's position was sound, and the district court, in fact, found that the government did not do anything wrong as a matter of law with the way that the government handled this matter. The district court further noted that in cases where the government makes a determination that it has no duty to disclose, it is a prudent thing for the government to seek a neutral evaluation from the district court, which is exactly what we did in this case. So we did not withhold this in terms of the court not knowing that there was something out there.
It's publicly available?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
I have the same question that Judge Griesbach does. Why the cloak and dagger here? Anybody can get this opinion on Westlaw.
But apparently it did not come up in the sentencing hearing, Your Honor, and so there was no questioning of the officer about it. So I understand your question, and it is possible that the defendant would have had it and this could have gone differently. But in fact, it did not come up in the sentencing hearing. If you have no other questions, then I will conclude with the request that for the reasons stated here and in our briefs, we respectfully request that this court dismiss the appeal as untimely, and if you consider the issues raised on appeal, that you affirm the district court's sentence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, if I may step
in. Yes, please. We consumed most of your time with procedural matters.
I understand. Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit's practitioner's handbook references, in addition to Rawlins, it references a case entitled U.S. v. Red that is also cited in the brief, which was a 2011 case. That opinion involved a motion to reconsider a sentence filed by a defendant. Judge Easterbrook, this court, in ruling on that motion, held that he had taken too long. Not because motions to reconsider didn't toll the time period, but because he'd waited beyond the time to appeal to file the motion to reconsider. So I would just refer the court to its decision, prior decision, in U.S. v. Red, which did involve a sentence and referenced that trio of Supreme Court cases as well as a basis for the defendant having the time to appeal to file a motion to reconsider a sentence.
It doesn't really talk about the prohibition in 3582.
It mentions that statute as well as Rule 35A in the next paragraph. You know, Your Honor, I'm looking in the opinion, the red opinion, at page 650, sure, where the court held that Red, the defendant, had 10 days to appeal and noted that he took 30 times that long to file his motion to reconsider. And then the next paragraph talks about the Sentencing Reform Act, talks about Rule 35, talks about Rule Section 3582C. So we believe the court was well aware of those issues when it previously indicated that a motion to reconsider a sentence was subject to this traditional rule in that trio of Supreme Court cases. If I could just correct, if the court has no further questions on the timeliness, if I could just correct one factual matter. Mr. Hanrahan, Officer Hanrahan, testified on March 21st, 2013. The government didn't make its ex parte motion until May 15th, 2013. So when the court considered the testimony of the Officer Hanrahan, it had not been apprised, at least by the ex parte motion, of Officer Hanrahan and Officer Murphy's involvement in the Simmons case. So, you know, at the end of the day, we again believe this is about due process. It's about fundamental fairness. We believe that this was a sentencing. It wasn't a jury trial. There's no reason why this couldn't have been done in the open. This information should have been provided to the defense, particularly since we had made specific requests for it. Officer Murphy had been on their witness list and was only taken off at the very last minute. And the court was certainly aware of some of the facts concerning the Simmons opinion, but we believe not all of them. And we believe it had been made fully aware, it would have led to a different outcome in terms of whether we'd been permitted to question Officers Murphy and Hanrahan about their prior practices and the decision that the court might have made. So we would ask for a reversal and a remand to allow us to explore this fully below.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr.